You want to see the Tallinn man? Keep watching this station. How many promises have you got written down over there that we got to find fulfillment of, you that have been listening to me every night? How many? 17? Let's go back to Deuteronomy. How many of you know that Moses blessed the sons of Jacob as well as Jacob did? You know that, don't you? Now Reuben lost his birthright. Sixth verse, he says, let Reuben live and not die, and let not his men be few. For Judah, he said in the seventh verse, this is the blessing of Judah. He said, hear, Lord, the voice of Judah, and bring him unto his people. Let his hands be sufficient for him, and be thou an help to him from his enemies. Now that sort of sounds like Judah's going to have some problems. But be thou a help to him from his enemies. Verse 13. God gave promises to Abram. We listed them the other night. He would become a great nation. God gave promises to Abraham and Sarah. Out of them would come a community of nations, a multitude of nations, and a multitude of kings. Their seed would possess the gates of their enemies. That blessing was divided by Jacob between the sons of Joseph and Judah. Judah would keep the scepter. The lawgiver would not disappear from between their feet. But the birthright was Joseph's. Through Ephraim. 10 tribes came to be known synonymous with Ephraim when the kingdom split. So whatever is to Joseph includes that. But of Joseph he said, blessed of the Lord be his land. For the precious things of heaven, for the dew, and for the deep that coucheth beneath. That just doesn't quite fit Samaria. Do you know that? You know that? How many of you have been there? A few. The precious things of heaven, for the dew and for the deep that coucheth beneath. That makes you think of somebody surrounded by ocean. For the precious fruits brought forth by the sun, that's okay, Palestine. For the precious things put forth by the moon, and for the chief things of the ancient mountains, and for the precious things of the lasting hills. For the precious things of the earth and fullness thereof, for the goodwill of him that dwells in the bush. Now up to that, though, the deep bit sort of gets to me. I could probably leave it in Palestine, but it starts getting a little rough now. Let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph and upon the top of the head of him that was separated from his brethren. His glory is like the firstling of his bullock. His horns are like the horns of unicorns. With them he shall push the people together to the ends of the earth. Now, wait a minute. Where has that happened? Don't tell me it's going to happen in the millennium, because the millennium is not a pushing time. You want to write 18 down to that one? Anybody want to tell me when the 10 tribes of Israel, the descendants of Joseph, have pushed the people together to the ends of the earth? May not be important to some of you. Very important to me. How many of you remember that I told you once I settled the resurrection, I set out on a journey and stated a ludicrous thing. Said, the sooner I find out God won't back His word, the better off I am. I got a little bit of life left to trust in something else. Now, paradoxically, that's a ludicrous statement, because God keeps doing it. But when I find something like this, don't tell me this is happening to Jews. When have they pushed anybody to the end of the earth? They've been pushed around to the end of the earth. Unless you think he's not talking about them, there is no punctuation in the original. He shall push the people together to the ends of the earth, and they are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. Where has that been fulfilled, my friends? Huh? Oh, yeah, I know where, what some of you think. But where in the Jews or the church or in Christ has that happened? Now, who were the Celts? Where were these people? I got out the usual collegiate dictionary, you know, the Webster one. You know what the dictionary said? I read it just before I got here tonight. It said, let's see what they say about the Celts. You know what they said the Celts were? Celtic-speaking people. So I looked up Celtic. You know what they said? Celtic is the language spoken by the Celts. I got an old ancient Funken Wagnalls dictionary that's about two volumes thicker than any one of those books there. I got it. And I wrote down what they had to say. Celt. A member of that Western European branch of the Aryan family that includes the Gaelic peoples. Who are, parenthesis, the Irish, the Erse, and the Manx, who settled the Isle of Man. A member of that Western European branch of the Aryan family that includes the Gaelic peoples, parenthesis, the Irish, Erse, and Manx, in parenthesis, and the Cymric. You can check your pronunciation for Cymric. You have two options, with a soft sound, pronounce it Cymric or Cymric. Both of them allowed. The most ancient being Cymric, as the most ancient pronunciation of Celt is Celt. Who are the Celts? A member of that Western European branch of the Aryan family that includes the Gaelic peoples. The Irish, Erse, and Manx, and the Cymric or Cymric, the Welsh, Cornish, Brizonics, or Low Britons. And what are the Scots? as the legendary half-divine, half-historian, depending upon, or half-historical personage, depending upon your source. Now, without question, we know they were historic people elevated to a quasi-divineship in subsequent legends. The Tuatha De Danann, they call them the worshippers of the goddess Danu. The only problem is, that doesn't tell you a thing about them. And you really trace that worship to Anna or Anu, not Danu. It translates literally, Tuatha De Danann, the tribe of Dan. Now, who are the Scoti? In Gaelic, that simply means wanderer. It's synonymous for Scythians, nomads or wanderers. It described their way of life. It was not a racial designation. They were Gaelic, and Gaelic were Celts. And the land came to be known as Scotland after the Irish settled it. Wandering Celts from Ireland, called Scoti, settled it, and it became known as Scotland. Where are the Cymry? Wales. At one time, these Celts constituted the most powerful confederacy of nations in Europe, until driven back by the Latin and Teutonic peoples. At one time, at the beginning of the historic period, when they appeared on the scene historically, though their lays and legends push their history behind that, they controlled Britain, Gaul, part of Spain, north of Italy, and some major provinces of Central Europe. Known to the Greeks as Celtoi, to the Romans as Celtae, called Gauls. Who are these Celts? Nobody knows. Nobody anywhere knows. You can only speculate. Anybody tells you they know for sure? They're not telling you facts. They're telling you opinion. That's the one I want? Yep. Interesting, National Geographic. Since her schoolgirl days, on a croft in Scotland, Dr. Anne Ross has been fascinated with the history of her Celtic ancestors. Today, as an archaeologist at the University of Southampton in England, she pioneers the theory that the historical and cultural origins of almost all Europe go back to the Celts. She pioneers baloney. This was written in 1926, and this one was written don't know when. Well, this is the 18th edition, and it's 1917. I can find you some other books in my library written in 1876. When they uncovered the Hallstatt culture in Austria and the Lautenae culture along a lake in Switzerland, the German dominance, as I've said, of history, philology, and archaeology and anthropology was busted apart. If they'd paid attention, Herodotus' writings, the father of ancient history, the Greek historian Herodotus, encountered them and described them. They were the Gauls described by Julius Caesar in his Gallic Wars. They appear out of nowhere. Everybody knows the dates. Pinned down now. Somewhere in the 7th century B.C., they appear. just north of the Caucasus Mountains. Nobody knows from where, except we know they didn't come out of Slavic and Eastern and Central Asia, because it was the movements of the Slavs, such as Genghis Khan and Attila the Hun, that swept in and drove them westward. They just appear with a full orb monarchy, with a belief in an afterlife, with a dual kind of rulership balanced between the king, who was king not because of power alone. He must live up to an ideal for kingship. Sharing power with a combination priest and prophet and poet, historian, scribe, who kept the history in memorized lays and poems of verse, who, according to Julius Caesar, must study 20 years to be this prophet, this olam, this seer. They just appear. They're nomadic. They are commended by Herodotus because they carry all their belongings in a wagon and take it with them wherever they go. They are master horsemen. Solomon had stables, tens of thousands of horses. But it was the Medes that developed it. That's the area they were settled, their horsemanship polished. Fame for the battle axe, bringing an iron culture that must be located first south of the Caucasus. Nowhere did it originate north. Nobody can figure out why the Bronze Age preceded the Iron Age. And the territory they went into, bronze is more difficult to alloy than iron. The Bronze Age predates the iron. These Celtic people appear on the scene, masters of iron. It originated south of the Caucasus, yet they are north of the Caucasus, between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. Where'd it come from? To answer that is to speculate. But the fact is unimpeachable. 7th century they appear before or above the Caucasus Mountains. Now, what happened south of the Caucasus Mountains just before that? The last quarter of the 8th century BC, the 10 tribes were carried into bondage, were settled between the Caspian Sea and the Tigris River. Darius, in an inscription, says they revolted about 50 to 55 years after they were carried into bondage. That put it about 675 B.C. in the 7th century B.C. Where were they settled? The scene of the captivity of Israel was the modern Persian province of Azerbaijan, with the adjoining southwestern shoreline of the Caspian. Names which may be met with today in the map of Persia are practically identical with those of the places to which, according to the several scriptural narratives, the 10 tribes were deported. Thus, Haru, between Tabriz and the coast, on any map today, I sat right here and located it for you a week or so ago, recalls Hara. Abhar, inland from Tehran, represents Haber, written in the Septuagint version with a silent H, Abor, Alamut in the mountain range of Damavand is Hala, written in the Septuagint version, the biblical description of where they were carried bondage to as Allah. While the only river of Upper Persia which finds its way to the sea at present is known as Uzan, in the 10th century A.D. is Gozan, in the opinion of the great Hebrew authority Yuld, the river of Gozan, by whose banks the captive Israelites were placed. They were settled also, the scripture says, in the, quote, cities of the Medes. The cities of the Medes were that same territory. Second Esdras reads, 13th chapter, 40th through 46th verse, I read it directly from it to you previously. Quote, Esdras is part of the apocryphal books, not accepted as canonized scripture, nonetheless as valid as history, and more so as Herodotus is accurate and more accurate on the Greeks than he is on the Thracians. Esdras, as one of their own, is more accurate on their own people. A letter was sent to these tribes settled among the Medes in the geographic areas just named somewhere around the first half of the 7th century B.C. asking them if they'd like to return. These are the 10 tribes, Ezra said, which were carried away prisoners out of their own land in the time of King Hoshea, whom Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, led away captive and carried them over the waters. And so they came into another land. Instead of wanting to come back, they took counsel among themselves that they would leave the multitude of the heathen and go forth into a further country where never mankind dwelt, that they might there keep their law, which they had never kept in their own land. Still quoting Esdras, and they entered into Euphrates by the narrow passages of the river. For the Most High then showed signs for them and held still the flood till they passed over. For through that country there was a great way to go, namely a year and a half. And the same region is called Ar-Sareth. Then dwelt they there until the latter time. Now there are some that say they came back with the two tribes to the south, Judah from Babylon. How many of you know that 2 Kings and Chronicles was not written until after they came back from Babylon? And the writer under divine inspiration says the house of Israel rebelled against Judah until this day. That settles it. They were not with the two tribes that came back, and Levi, Benjamin, Judah, from Nebuchadnezzar's bondage. They got an invitation from Esdras. They took counsel, and they went north to Ar-Sareth. Now, Ar simply means city or hill. That's all. The same region is called Ar-Sareth, city of Sareth, or hill of Sareth. This writer says, here then is a distinct assertion of the escape of the Israelites leading them from Media across the upper waters of the Euphrates into the then thinly populated regions of the northwest. It is to the northwest that traces are found of the name Ar-Sareth, which name some commentators have corrected to Aretseth, which signifies in Hebrew lands, which is an error. It's Ar-Sareth. Ar is the Greek transliteration of two Hebrew words meaning severally, hill or city. Sareth may well be a local name, so that the whole may mean either the hill or city of Sareth. To this day, one of the tributary streams flowing from the Carpathian Mountains into the Danube near its mouth is the river Sareth. Near its source among the mountains is a city of Sereth. The river itself drains a district of some 300 miles in length by 50 miles in breadth. Why can this not be the Ahr Sereth of Esdras? If so, the 10 tribes, if Esdras is telling the truth, the 10 tribes left the district immediately south of the Caucasus Mountains around 650 B.C., middle of the 7th century, and their first settlements in the new continent were immediately to the northwest of the Black Sea by Ahr Sereth. Now, immediately, in the middle of the 7th century, they begin to be recognized. They are recognized by Herodotus, who first calls them Thracians, or Scythians, that means nothing more than descriptively calling them nomads. Now, what about Kimri, Simri? What are we going to do with that? The sixth king of the 10 tribes of Israel moved the capital and put the capital at Samaria. And ever after, the northern tribes came to be known as the House of Samaria. You know that already. When Sargon wrote his inscriptions, recording them, not in any Christian frame, when archaeologists dug it up, that's where I left Lawyard with the one-eyed Pasha down there in Syria. I'm ahead of the story. When they thought Nimrod came to life and those winged bulls of Assyria suddenly came out of the desert as he uncovered them. Sargon and Darius left a record of their wars. Sargon, who captured the city of Samaria in 722 B.C. Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser, and Sargon, the rulers of Assyria, referred to the 10 tribes not as Ephraim, not as Israel, but rather as Beth-Kumri. Beth for house of, Kumri, Umri. Umri being the captain, as they translate, or the king, the sixth king, who built Samaria. They followed the pattern of Assyrian of linking a kingdom with a king, because they had a tendency to give divinity to their kings. So when the capital was Samaria, and Umri, the sixth king, built it, they then had to make the difficult phrase in their language, and the transition made it end up as a designation of the people that they conquered as Beth Kumri, which any philologist knows can be traced to the Kimri. They just dropped the word Beth, house of, and they came to be known as the Kimri. That's the name that they were known as. I'll read it to you here. Simply translated. When Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, preceding Sargon, who finished the job of conquering Samaria, who led Israel into captivity, made a record of that captivity on the tablets of Assyria. And when I go back to the one-eyed Pasha and read it from the archaeological book, as I read segments earlier, I'll read it directly from that. How many of you remember when I pulled out of my briefcase the direct archaeological records and read it about 2 weeks ago, the translation of the inscriptions, when we showed you the picture of Darius' inscription in three separate languages? I'm just reading you a summary tonight because we've got to catch ourselves back up. When he inscribed on the tablets of Assyria, not dug up, mind you, until the 1800s, he called them the House of Umri, Beth Kumri, because it was the city built by Umri that was the capital, and the whole nation was being called Samaria. In true Assyrian style, when he conquered the king, he conquered the king's nation. Therefore, he lost all sight. Since Samaria was founded by Omri, the whole people he conquered were called by him House of Omri, Beth Cumri, pronounced in their language. When Israel was confederate with reason, king of Syria, and went against the Jews besought Tiglath-Pileser, who was at that time king of Assyria, to become their confederate. That's in the Bible. He also, in his records, not in the Bible, referred to Israel as the Beth Cumri, in the annals of Sargon, who was also a king of Assyria, successor of Shalmaneser, predecessor of Sennacherib of biblical fame. Israel is called Beth Cumri. Their capital city is called simply Cumri. On the Nimrud obelisk, which I'll get back to the one-eyed Pasha and Lawyard and show you pictures of. On the Nimrod obelisk, it's written, Jehu, the son of Omri. That's the translation. It is written, Yahuwah Abil Cumri. Professor Rawlinson, no British Israelite, says, quote, Jehu is usually called in the Bible the son of Nimshi, although Jehoshaphat was his actual father. But the Assyrians, taking him for the legitimate successor to the throne, named as his father, or rather ancestor, Omri, the founder of the kingdom of Samaria. Therefore, in their mistaken identity, because Omri founded the city and they gave him the title of founder of the kingdom, Omri's name was written on the obelisk, as it is in the inscriptions of Shalmaneser, where the kingdom of Israel is always called the country of Beth Cumri. The title son of Omri is equivalent to that of king of Samaria, the city which Omri built and which is known to the Assyrians as Beth Cumri. Now the name Kimri or Simri is in reality the plural of Kimro, which literally means a Welshman. And the country of the Kimri is called by themselves Kimru, which has been Latinized into the well-known name of Cambria. The letter V in the Welsh language has two powers, and both of these powers are active in the word Kimri. It sounds as you, and it's just exactly like the word Kyrios in Greek, the most difficult word that you can pronounce. It's somewhere, you've got to put your mouth and your voice somewhere halfway between an E and an U sound. And very few people, including me, ever are able to say it. We're like the people in the Bible that couldn't say Shibboleth. On the map of Britain facing St. George Channel is a group of counties called Wales, inhabited by a people distinct from and but very imperfectly understood by those who surround them. Their neighbors call them Welshmen. Welsh or Walsh is not a proper name. It's a Teutonic or German term, signifying strangers, and was applied to all persons who were not of that family. The proper and original name of these people is Kimri. They are the last remnant of the Kimmeroi of Homer and the Kimri of Germany. On I can go. Accidents, you call it? Who are the Saxons? Huh? There's a constant habit in the Hebrew of dropping first letters. Joshua becomes Ashwa. Jews had a preference for the name Jacob. But what did Jacob say after he'd been named Israel to Joseph? They shall bear my name. He said something else. They shall bear Isaac's name. You'll always find the 10 tribes preferred Isaac. After they were taken into captivity, they dropped the name Israel, called themselves Sok. Just dropping the I. How far do you want me to go tonight? The word Saxon is derived from the Hebrew name of Isaac, together with an affix which means sons of. Professor Totten says, in most of the Eastern language, sons of is written Sunia. It's equivalent to the Scottish Mac. If somebody's called MacDonald, that means they're the son of Donald. If they're called Fitzpatrick, that means they're the son of Patrick. MacDonald, son of Dunn, Fitzhenry, or Donald Fitzhenry, son of Henry. So in the distant home of these Celtic ancestors, perhaps, Saka, Sunia, means sons of Isaac. Stamboul is formed of Istanbul, dropping the prefix. This is probably one of the most concise gleanings of it. I read it to you before. It's a little curious to glean from the ancient nations and from the stone monuments of the early times the various forms in which this word is to be found, Sakasuni. Here are just a few. Sons of Isaac, sons of Sak, Sakasuni, Sakasana, Sakasena, Sakapena, Esaka, Saka Amirki, Beth Sakai, Suni Sakai, Sakasana, Sakasana, Sakasune, Sakishnina, Sakasunia, Sakasin, Sakasun, Sakasani, Saksaini, Saksuna, Saksuni, Sachi, Sacha, Sakasakas, Sakasako, Sacho, Sakso, Saksoi, Saksonia, Saxon, Saksai, Saxon, 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 Saxony, Saxons. Now these are facts. Whether or not these were the lost tribes or not, I don't know. All I know is, Darius says they revolted about 650 B.C. to 670 B.C. All I know is that Ezra says they went through the headwaters of the Euphrates and chose to go to a country to the north, lightly or not inhabited at all. It took them a year and a half to go through the Caucasus Mountains. All I know is that Josephus says they never really united. Millions of them, multitude of them, still dwelled apart from the Jews. When Kings and Chronicles was written, it is recorded, in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, they were still rebelling against the house of Judah until that day. And then all of a sudden the Celts appear. Out of nowhere. They just happened to be in the spot where the other people went. And what do? They encounter the Greeks. And their first written language is to adopt the Greek language but write it backwards, like Hebrews. They've become known as Kimri, which is but house of Umri, Assyrianized. They are known as Sakasuni, Saxons. Scripture says Dan will judge his people. And I've already told you, that doesn't mean sit in judgment. It means make decisions and render verdicts. A judge doesn't just say guilty or not guilty. He designates a record. He tells you what is officially and acceptable in the record. When it says Dan shall judge his people, it's the King James trying to be fancy English in style. What the original says, Dan shall Dan his people. How does a judge signify what he has designated for a record? Huh? He puts his name on it. You don't go in with a search warrant. The first thing you look for is the judge's signature, his name. Don't mess up the original with English meanings. Dan's going to Dan. Wherever Dan goes, he's going to Dan. And everywhere you read about in the Bible, they go to Lachish, they conquer, they name it Dan after their father. Go to another place, formerly known as this, now it's Dan. Wherever Dan goes, bang, they put their seal down because that was prophesied to them. I don't know whether this is the source of the names, but what if they were? The seal marker tribe. They carry the seal of the tribe, figuratively speaking. All I know is There are no vowels in the Hebrew. Dan can equally be din, dom, dan, dun. And everywhere these cells go, you find Dnieper, Dniester, Danube, Don. Where are they first encountered by the Greeks? They're called Thracians by the Greeks, but they're Jetai and Moeshi. That's the name of the tribes. They are tribes. And they worship Zalmoxes. That's heathen history, which means Chief Moses, who taught them to believe in the afterlife. And Herodotus says he tricked them by disappearing, going living underground for a while, and then coming back again. Isn't it interesting? They don't know where Moses was buried. They're encountered as tribes, Moaxes. To the north of them is the Danube, to the south of them is Macedonia, to the south of them is the Dardanelles. They end up in Danemark, which means Dan's Mark, or Dan's resting place, alternate translations, that rules all of Scandinavia. Nobody can tell me. I can't find anywhere where anybody can tell me with absolute certainty where did their symbol come from. Where did Denmark get its symbol? Tell me that. Nobody can tell me. Where in the world? See if I can get a picture of it here. I'll show you this one. I'm not going to do you like the Tallinn man. Just relax. Where did Denmark get this seal? You want to tell me that? That's when they ruled Norway and Sweden, and little Denmark ruled it all. You know what that is? That's a lion with a serpent's tail. Where did that symbolism come from? Ancient King's Seal. You say Christian influence? Come on. Dan shall be a serpent's trail, literally. Lion with a serpent's tail. The large one being Denmark, the smaller ones Norway and Sweden. London. Take yourself a map of Ireland and England and find the dens and the dans and the dons. And they finally end up, everybody agrees, the last place the cells settled that you can find them in some purity is in Ireland, Scotland, and England. A little bit in Brittany. They built large circular forts all over Ireland. Everywhere you turn, you got these circular forts. We've already shown them to you. There's no Christian, no British Israelite, no Hebraic book. McAllister, The Archaeology of Ireland. Stone forts. Isn't that interesting that they all are named the same way? Is Dun and Gusa. Dun O'Not. Dun O'Keel. Dun Connor. Circular forts like no other place. Obviously speaking of a people ready to make their last stand. Ireland's a jumping off place into the Atlantic. There's no place else to go. You find forts like that in Palestine. The Celtic language, backward like Hebrew, only place. And I've already told you, let me check you. This is review and test time. What is the Gaelic? An Irish word for judge. Dun. D-U-N-N. I didn't do this. I didn't have to call judges dun. That's what they are. Now in the Hebrew there are no vowels. There's only consonants. This can be Dan, Din, Din, Don, Dun. No certain spelling for it. The vowels are added. You got Dons and Duns and Dins and Donegals all over the place. Long before the Romans came. In some cases, much less before the Christians came. That's fact. It is fact the Celts appeared north of the Caucasus at exactly the time in history when the 10 tribes are said by Esdras to have gone north through the Caucasus. Why is it so hard? And why is Christianity so afraid to face up to that truth? God said they weren't lost. They appear, moving ever westward and provide the Hallstatt and the Latine culture of Northern Europe that we now know was both more advanced in many respects than the Greeks and the Romans ever were. You can read the Bible and know where Berith comes from. That's the way they translate it in English. But there are no vowels. You can write it just like that. There are no vowels in the Hebrew language. You can go to Hebrew and you've got Berith. Don't lay any trip on me about the cultist. I'm interested in history. Where do these tribes go? Berith is a biblical word. It simply means covenant. Ish is a biblical word. It simply means man. British. It's covenant man. You say, do you know that's the source? No, nobody knows in etymology. If I only found one word, I wouldn't pay any attention. But when they start coming at me from all sides, I start listening. Is they going to build a case on that? No, I can find some other semantics that might possibly, it's just like they argue for years on the source of the word Rus. I already gave you one. Arsareth. Some try to say that's a cognitive Artsareth, which simply means land. Instead of what is clearly written down by the original writer, Arsareth. If I had no Duns, I wouldn't be as impressed with the British. If I had no Celtic language that reads backwards like Hebrew, Greek going backwards, for no explanation, except to people learning the letters for the first time who were habituated into going backwards. Do you know that everywhere they were punished? They were vassals of Syria. They were vassals. They had very little time when they were independent. Once the 10 kings were formed, they were constantly under somebody. And Ahab married the daughter of the Phoenician king. The Syrians were not their first conquerors. They were vassals of Syria, vassals of the Phoenicians, and ultimately conquered by Assyria. They learned after a while their religion got them in trouble. They translated it into a great mystery. I wouldn't be impressed if I just had Dons all over the place. But I get a little more impressed when I have Dons and Duns and the judge is called. I get even more impressed when I pull an archaeology book out. The one I was just looking at, wherever in the world I put it. I get even more impressed when I pull out the archaeology book, and he is the one that tells me the source of their Ogham language and their Celtic Greek. I get even more impressed when I pull out of my books this Sumas McManus, the story of the Irish race. And he tells me these chief hospitality centers of Ireland were asylums of refuge for homicides like the six Jewish cities of refuge. Why six? Why not five? Suddenly they're just discovered on the scene in Ireland with these hospitality centers, which was always set at the junction of several roads, frequently the junction of six. It had open doors facing every road, a man stationed on each road to make sure that no one passed unentertained. It had a light burning on the lawn all night and full cauldrons always boiling on the fire. It was stocked with provisions of all kinds of plenty. But six chief ones were asylums of refuge. Where'd that come from? Long before Joshua built the six cities of refuge, and only six, because the seventh one's Christ. Moses told him to appoint places of refuge. Here are these Celts landing in Ireland with cities of refuge there before anybody got there to find them. Then I find Kimri, retaining the name of House of Kimri. The Celts settled in Wales. I find Scoti, Celtic synonym for Scythians, nomads or wanderers, which is the way Herodotus describes them. And I find Brith, Covenant-ish man, Isles. Covenant man, Isles. I find Sakasuni, sons of Isaac. I let facts overwhelm me. Too much here to ignore. They all appear at the same time. Nobody knows where they came from. Bless her heart. This is where I started. Sweet little lady she is. Since her school days in a croft in Scotland, Dr. Annie Ross has been fascinated with the history of her Celtic ancestors. Today, as an archaeologist at the University of Southampton in England, she pioneers the theory that the historical and cultural origins of almost all Europe go back to the Celts. First-hand research has taken her to many Celtic sites, such as the hill fort at Pilsden Pen in England, where she walked with landowner Michael Penny. Up here is a picture of it. The National Geographic brought Dr. Ross to the United States to consult on the article about the Celts and to assist designer John Doerr in preparing the supplement map that accompanies this issue. Your friends will want to read such vivid recreation of the past. Nominate them for membership today. I ought to get a free membership for that, for somebody. What does this pioneer have to say? Get through the advertisements. Here we go. How many times have you heard this? The Celts were a group of related tribes linked by language, religion, and culture that gave rise to the first civilization north of the Alps. They emerged as a distinct people in the 8th century B.C. How many times have you heard that from every source? They all jump out just nowhere. Here they are, north of the Caucasus. Nobody will link them at all to the 10 tribes to the south. They were energetic and most inventive. They introduced to northern Europe the use of iron. Where did iron work originate? South of the Caucasus. Well, how'd they get it? They didn't come from there. Say you're done? Nope. Got a few more little things to happen. It is now more than 250 years since a Danish peasant who with his daughter was following their plow in their native country when the daughter's plow turned up a bright and glittering something which upon examination proved to be a golden trumpet. Taken to authorities, it was identified as one of the 7 golden trumpets used in the altar service at the temple at Jerusalem. ornamented with a lily and a pomegranate. The lily being the national flower of Egypt, the pomegranate that of Palestine. How many know that the sons of Joseph were half and half? Egypt and Palestine. Thus showing the half Egyptian, half Israelitish origin of the birthright nation of which Dan was a part. Isn't that nifty little things? Now when you go back, when you go with me to Ireland, I want you to look for something. I've already told you this, I'm just reviewing. Because I've got to get on now with these promises and God's Word. And I'm going to start taking a stand myself, which you've been waiting for. Anywhere the Phoenicians went, you would find family names with the word Baal in it. Now understand me, the Phoenicians were seagoing people, but also with the Phoenicians, Dan abode in ships, and both Dan and Simeon had a seacoast colony south of Judah at the time Assyria conquered them, and that portion of Dan and Simeon did not get conquered and carried into bondage. They abode in ships. Plying the Mediterranean were the ships of Dan as well as the ships of the Phoenicians. Wherever the Phoenicians went, worshippers of Baal, Jezebel was the daughter of the Phoenician king. That's why she brought Baal worship into Israel as she married the Israel king, or the house of Israel's king, Ahab, in Elijah's day. Wherever, this is a review, you'll remember it, wherever the Phoenicians went, you could tell the difference between them and a Hebrew, the house of Israel. The Phoenicians would name both families and places after Baal. Little thing. But it's the multiplicity of things that I'm paying attention to. So if you find a family with the word Baal in it, living in a place that has the word Baal in it, such as Ethbaal, Ithabal, Osgerbal, and Hannibal, there's a famous one, Hannibal. If you find the word Baal in a family name, as well as a place name, you can pretty much know a Canaanite or a Phoenician or a heathen lived in that place, because they named both people and places after Baal. The house of Israel, when they began to blend with idols, they kept a sort of freakish purity. They would name places after Baal, but they would only name places and people after God. So when you come to a cultural area and you'll find all kinds of places named after Baal, but you don't find a proliferation equal of family names after Baal, you got a clue. No doubt it was a Hebrew type people who brought the Baal name in, but they named men and families after God. They named places and only places after Baal. They also named places after God. But they don't name any people after God. Got that? You go all over Ireland, you'll find places like this. Ballyby, Ballygowan, Ballynaish, Ballycastell, Ballymoney, Ballynair, Ballygarry, Ballyna, Ballycon, Ballyhigh, Ballyhull-ish, Ballynabrock, Ballyoffy, Balldoggan. You don't find people like Hannibal, Osgerbal, Ethbal, Ithabal. They were prone to name people like Israel, Lemuel, Samuel, Ezekiel, Elisha, Elijah, Haramon, Moishi. You got what I'm saying? Now, if Baal worshippers from Phoenicia settled Ireland, How come you don't have family names with Baal in it? How come we haven't got a lot of Mac Hannibals? How come we got some Fitz Ithabals? I mean, just drive, can't you just get excited about driving down through Wiltshire District and seeing a four-leaf green clover saying, come in for some Irish stew at Fitz Hannibals? Or Mac Bailtech. Sure do find a lot of McDonald's. You even find some McDonovans. A few McDonagles. Shall I show you that Tallinn man? Yes, sir. Sir Ken Wright, wouldn't it?
Yes,
let's do it. Let's do it. Just serve him right. Just show you I'm not as ornery as you think I am. Now, there he was on the cover if you'd have looked. See, he's all tied up, just laying in a on his side. Let me give you a picture of him. There it is, blown up, if we can get it close. That's exactly the way he was uncovered in that peat bog. Two thousand years ago he was placed in that peat bog. See if I got the close-up of him. I'll tell you more about the Tallinn man some other time. Maybe this black... I was looking for the color. I got it somewhere, a color picture of this, but this will show you how clearly outlined his features. That's a... Talk about a mummy. That's not mummified. That's a 2,000-year-old man in the peat bog in Denmark. They finally begin to discover that archaeology could find some things in the lands of the European prehistoric cultures. Can you believe that? 2,000 years old. That's right. Somebody said over there he wasn't a bad-looking man. I find that unbelievable. What archaeology's been doing in the last 200 years, the 1800s. If Ken is watching, I want him to call right now. He owes me one. I did that for him. Now, I'm telling you, folks, that there is too much here to ignore. Now, what are we going to do with the record of 585 B.C.? That an old prophet who founds the school of the prophets, Mur Olam, shows up with a daughter of the king from King Heramon, usually referred to as Aramon, dropping the H, married. And it's from the lineage of Aramon and Tiatephi, that daughter of the king that came with the old prophet, who is accompanied by a helper called Simon Breck. What are you going to do with that? And who was Aramon? And what happened to Zara? That's the one we got to get us back to. You know, I got so many things dangling. If I don't tie the summary back out here, and what's the one? What happened to One-Eyed Pasha? Now, I want you to know I'll be here tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Normally, we're not live on Thursday. We will be tomorrow night. You got that? I'm going to let you run around Friday night. But I got to be here tomorrow night to see if you do tomorrow what you promised you'd do earlier that saved our life. Plus the fact you got that 18 written down? Verse 17, chapter 33 of Deuteronomy. When has Joseph and the tribes of Joseph pushed the people together to the ends of the earth? You want translation of the ends of the earth? It's literal. You get it later on. But I can tell you who did the pushing. Not Judah, not the church, not Jesus. They are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. And where did they become 10,000s of Ephraim and thousands of Manasseh? Go back to Hosea. Chapter 1, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living God. In the place that they are scattered, they're to become that. And they're going to push the people together to the ends of the earth. Greatest warriors that ever lived were the Celts. But they had a strange custom. They didn't engage in a phalanx like Alexander the Great. Their champions would go out and challenge champions from the other side to hand-to-hand combat. Their disregard of death because of the teaching of Zalmoxes of another life was such that they would challenge the leading warriors of the opposite side to hand-to-hand combat. Where do you think the fighting Irishmen get their background? To hand-to-hand combat, and with their swords and their shields, start naked, usually. They'd take on the Roman legionaries with all their armies and beat the way out of them. Dan shall leap from Bashan. Where? Doesn't say, does it? But Dan will Dan his people wherever they go. Just be with them for that purpose. Do you think I ought to ignore this or keep going? Huh? I mean, why give it over to the nuts? Why don't we smart people sort it out? Huh? That's exactly what we're going to do, folks. Why do you think Jesus said? How many know He said it? Go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Huh? Why did He say that if they weren't around? I mean, was it another one of those chapters that wouldn't come out right if God didn't add a line? Huh? Did Jesus tell them to go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel or not? Peter addressed his letter to the strangers dispersed. You know what the Greek cognate for Jezreel is? If you read in the Old Testament Jezreel, you want the cognate in the Greek, is diasporo, dispersion, scattered. Now, when Peter wrote his letter to the scattered in Asia, literally he said to the Jezreel of Asia. Where did Zara go? Huh? I mean, God didn't put that chapter in there just because He wanted to compete with Penthouse and Playboy in later days. That chapter in Genesis about Judah, that daughter-in-law of his that trapped him because of his carnality. Why is Zara dangling? Don't get on to me for dangling things. God dangled Zara ever since Matthew wrote it. Just dangled Zara of the tribe of Judah. Just dangling out there. Where did Zara go? Huh? Where'd Jeremiah die? Why is this woman saying she's a pioneer? Now, I ask all my singers to be here tonight, and I want to thank them. I ask everybody to come tonight because I fully expected that if I could get the courage and you weren't faithful, we'd be here all night to raise $30,000. You did it by 10 o'clock. I commend you. I don't want to neglect the singers. I don't want to spoil them, because paradoxically, just like God, I expect them to do it when we need it. But on the other side of the coin, I appreciate the fact they did it, because they're assigned, they're all volunteers for the most part, they are assigned different nights, and they all came tonight. I got them all here except the honeymooners up the hill. And I'm telling you, if we'd had to go all night, I'd have woke them up. They came, my engineers really put out, we're on the air because of them. You came through tonight. You know, it makes me like you so much that I'm liable to go weak and stay here tonight and undangle everything. And we'd still be here all night. But I ain't going to do it. I'll be here at 8 o'clock tomorrow night, and you better be there. We've got to figure out where these Kimry and Celts and Dans and Sakasuni and Saxons and Brith-ish people came from. And what about Zara? And what about Jeremiah? And what makes her think she's a prophet? That's where we're going to be tomorrow night at exactly 8 o'clock. And what do you know? I may have a colored picture of this Tallinn man. Just hold on a minute. I think I have. I want the ensemble. Where are the Celts today? I just happened to see that. Where are the Celts today? Here's a map. Where are the Celts today? Take a look at it. Scotland, Ireland, that's where the red, where they survived is the deep red. Where they've been revived is the rest of the territory. Cornwall, Isle of Man, no, just Isle of Man, Cornwall is where they've been revived. The red areas, Wales, Brittany, Ireland, Scotland, there's the purest Celts in the world today. Now, if they are the 10 tribes, I'm telling you, I ain't going to give them to the British Israelites. I'm going to figure out what's happening. Then I may go over there, fix this bell tower, and ring it loud, and say, come and listen. They're going to sing.